Okay, thank you very much. I'm happy to be back to the time room where I gave a talk about the same thing some time ago. a few years ago.
Change the talk?
Well, a little bit. the topic is the same, but there is something new. And the thing that is new, so some years ago, I came up with this idea, this scenario for which seems to me the most natural thing to expect as a resolution for the Hawking evaporation, the Hawking information puzzle in the context of black hole evaporation, in a theory of quantum gravity, if quantum gravity is such that space-time, smooth space-time is an emergent quantity from an underlying physics that is fundamentally discrete. But, so the seminar I gave a few years ago was just about the scenario in which one can actually not do things in detail. So what is new about, what is new today is that I want to show you that in the context of quantum cosmology, one can realize the scenario precisely as a toy model, okay? So the key idea that will go through all the talk is the irreversibility associated, the irreversibility of physics that emerges when one has complexity combined with special initial conditions and coarse graining. So fundamental laws of physics are time, most of them are time symmetric, time reversal symmetric. However, in familiar situations, an arrow of time emerges, and the way in which we can think about this arrow of time is well represented by this cartoon by Penrose. So if this is phase space and we start from some special configurations in phase space, then Liouville's theorem tells us that the volume of phase space occupied by the system cannot change through time evolution. However, it doesn't tell us anything about the shape of this volume. And so this can evolve into something very intricate. And if I am an observer that has some limited capabilities of distinguishing points in phase space, I would think that the volume of the phase space occupied by the system is growing, and then I would interpret that entropy is becoming bigger and larger towards the future. So what I want to stress is that gravitational collapse and the eventual evaporation of a black hole is something like that. So first of all, in classical gravitational collapse, it's a highly time asymmetric process. The past is very different from the future. We start from diluted initial conditions where matter is not very dense, and a star forms, and eventually it collapses to form a black hole. So the past is weak fields. In the future, we have an event horizon and the black hole and a singularity inside from the classical perspective. So there are all the ingredients of the picture we had before. The past is very special because we declare it to be special. And the future develops into this object, produces this object that is a black hole. One of the manifestations of this time asymmetry is the fact that the black holes, from the classical perspective, seems to lose all the information of what formed it. And this is the content of the no-hair theorem. So we can make a black hole from a star or from a collection of objects and garbage. At the end of the day, the only thing that matters is its mass, its angular momentum, and eventually its electric charge, when we wait long enough so that the black hole settles down to a stationary situation. So also related to this is our Hawking's area theorem that says that under the usual energy conditions, which are expected to hold in the classical context, then the area of the black hole can only increase. So if I look at the area of the black hole at a given instant, represented by this Cauchy surface, and I look at it later, then the area can only increase. And this is a direct manifestation of this time asymmetry of the background that represents the gravitational collapse. That is very much key in the very definition of the horizon of the black hole that is defined teleologically as the boundary of the past of future null infinity. So another important manifestation of the high time asymmetry of the gravitational collapse is Hawking radiation. So if you go into the details of the calculation of Hawking, it is very important that you start with this very special initial conditions, which is the vacuum, and then due to the time asymmetry of the whole space-time, then you find that observers near future null infinity would observe radiation particles coming at a given temperature, at Hawking temperature, emanating from the black hole. Now, if you wouldn't respect the time arrow of this background, and you would decide to put a boundary condition here that declares that the state of the quantum field is just a vacuum in the future, then you run into a complete contradiction with this background, and you find that the energy momentum tensor, the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor in this quantum state, just blows up at the horizon. So these boundary conditions are compatible with the arrow of time intrinsic of this of the gravitational collapse. Those boundary conditions do not make sense. And of course, I mean, all this is related to the fact that black holes in the semi-classical regime, so when they become quasi-stationary, we should say, because they actually evaporate, then when we exchange matter with them, then they behave, they satisfy a balance law, that is the first law, where there is this heat term, the temperature, Hawking temperature appears multiplying this change in the area, that leads to this natural interpretation of the area of 4 in Planck units as the entropy of the black hole, and the generalized second law follows from it. So this heat term points to the necessity of some, I mean, if you want to explain this from some fundamental description, from some quantum gravity description, then this heat term or the existence of the entropy term in the fact that black holes have an entropy strongly suggests the existence of microstates that should be responsible for this entropy. So in loop quantum gravity, one can try to compute this entropy out of the microscopic excitations in quantum gravity, and what one finds, or what one basically does, is one counts the number of states of the black hole horizon that are compatible with some with macroscopic numbers such as the mass, the angular momentum of this of a classical black hole. So the key property that leads to the possibility of getting an entropy for a black hole is that for a given semi-classical state, for a given classical state of the black hole, there are, in the theory, many, many different states, microstates, of the quantum geometry of the horizon. So the central point that goes into this calculation is the assumption that for a given classical geometry, in the fundamental theory, has many, many states. There are many, many microstates that correspond to the very same classical geometry. So it is implicit to this that even if I talk about flat space-time in the fundamental theory, in a theory such as loop quantum gravity, there should be a huge degeneracy. And the existence of this degeneracy is what will be the key in resolving the Hawking information paradox. Okay, this is just an approximation. This is not the end of the story, because black holes evaporate. And if you draw a Penrose diagram that, like this one, representing black hole evaporation, then you run into troubles if you want to think of things in terms of a unitary S matrix. Because naively speaking, if you look at this diagram, you see that you have a Cauchy surface here in which you can encode a pure state defining the gravitational collapse and the quantum fields living on it. But after evaporation, this red surface here is not a Cauchy surface, and so it seems that you wouldn't be able to have a unitary evolution from the blue one to the red one, and this is the key of the of Hawking's information paradox. However, in quantum gravity, at least in certain models, it seems that that Penrose diagram should be replaced by something like this, in which there is evolution across a region, the would-be singularity, the region where we expect the singularity to be from the classical point of view, is this shaded region that has high curvatures close to the Planckian and high fluctuations. So the very classical geometry might not even make sense here. But what we expect is that there will be an after the singularity. At least this, there are certain models that suggest this. These models are very simple. Usually these are models that involve a finite number of degrees of freedom. If you have a Penrose diagram like this, you might think that your life is easier, but the problem remains. So if you consider an initial state of the situation, then you think of this blue Cauchy surface here, and you might think that there should be a way of making sense of a unitary evolution that goes from the blue one to the red one. In the blue one, you have the quantum field excitations that involve the particles that are being radiated, the Hawking radiation, which is correlated with particles that are falling into the singularity. In the future, you have the Hawking radiation, and if you expect this to be a unitary process, then this Hawking radiation has to be correlated with something here in the future. And the problem is that if you trust quantum field theory on curved space-times in the situations where you don't have any reasons not to trust it, then you see that if you look at things from future null infinity here, you would observe that the mass of the black hole is slowly, very slowly being radiated. So the bonding mass of the black hole goes down slowly until you reach an object that has a mass of the order of the Planck mass, and until then you can trust Hawking's calculation. So until very late, so you end up with something which you end up with a black hole that has only Planck mass. So there is only Planck mass available, and a huge amount of Hawking radiation that you have to correlate with what? You have to correlate it with something that cannot take a lot of energy. You have only a Planck mass available to give to realize this degrees of freedom that should be correlated with the Hawking radiation, and so that's the problem. Now, the space-time is basically flat here in this region because there is no mass available to curve the space-time. So the space-time seen from infinity is basically Minkowski space-time here. So the point I want to stress is that if this flat space-time is highly degenerate, so if the quantum theory is such that when we say flat space-time, in fact, we have a huge degeneracy encoded in the microscopic degrees of freedoms, then this is the perfect reservoir of degrees of freedom with respect to which we can correlate all the Hawking quanta without taking a lot of energy. So in other words, I can have something that macroscopic observers perceive as flat space-time, but in the details at the Planck scale, there will be minor differences that coarse-grained observers do not perceive, and those differences, those defects, are the ones that would be correlated with the Hawking radiation to purify the final state. So if that is the case, then you cannot describe these degrees of freedom in terms of any effective field theoretical framework. These degrees of freedom are the genuine discrete degrees of freedom at the Planck scale. So in a sense, particle pairs are created here. One goes to infinity and produces Hawking radiation, and the ones that are correlated fall into the singularity. They go into the high curvature regime. They kick those fundamental Planckian degrees of freedoms and transfer the correlations to these Planckian degrees of freedoms, and the correlations survive in the future to purify the state. So this is a cartoon for the same thing. So in this red future Cauchy surface, we have Hawking radiation correlated with defects in the structure of space-time. It's unclear whether these defects should be thought as defects on a space slice, or rather, what we have is this collection of Hawking quanta correlated with just different four-dimensional geometries here in the future, all of which are basically flat, but different, differing in microscopic details that we are not sensitive to if we study the system from the point of view of effective field theory. Okay, so another picture of the same thing. So this represents the formation of the black hole. We have an initial instant where we have diluted matter that eventually collapses and produces a black hole. The picture is meant to emphasize the different time scales. So this is the formation of the star, and the collapse that forms the black hole is very short. And then for a very long time, our black hole is evaporating. There is a would-be singularity inside. And something, when the black hole becomes Planckian in size, then quantum effects should be important. And these Planckian defects I'm talking about get deconfined to purify the whole of the Hawking radiation that has come out. Okay, one would like to have the calculation. Yes?
Should I just think of these as a type of remnants? I mean, this kind of scenario.
If you want, but the remnant is something point-like that remains there. Okay. While these things are not necessarily localized where the black hole was.
Do you have some, they look like dots. But
well, I have to draw something.
Sure. Should I think of them as like some? So I shouldn't think of them as localized objects. Should I think of them kind of?
No. You can think of them as localized, but they are not all localized in the same place. I mean, you don't need to think. I mean, the problem of remnants is that usually people think of them as a point particle-like object with a huge number of internal states. This is not the case here. So what you should...
You said that they were light and that there was a huge number of states.
Yes.
So, but I thought that was sufficient. So that was the main reason why people don't like remnants. If you have some large, very large number of low energy states, if you have any amplitude at all to go to...
If it's a particle-like object, this is why people don't like it. Because you would treat it in effective field theory as a field. And then you would have huge probabilities of creating these particles because of a huge number of internal states. While here, what you have, I mean, the picture would be more like this one. So this is, think of this as a space geometry to the future of this singularity in the region where the space-time is supposed to be flat. So this is some slice of flat space-time. That when, if you look with the magnifying glass, you will find all sorts of defects, localized, but in scattered around a very large region.
Sure, but the question is, why does black hole evaporation produce these? If black hole evaporation can produce these defects, why can't an ordinary scattering process produce these defects? Or can't?
I mean, you need.
I think you have a.
I mean, The key, well, maybe the example, maybe the second part of the talk, because it's just an introduction, I will show you an example, which is quantum cosmology. Why? The answer is that you need to interact with the Planckian scale to be able to excite these states. Okay? So here you have excited these defects because to the past of this region of space-time you have a singularity, a would-be singularity, a region of very, very high fluctuations at the Planck scale, something that you never have in a particle physics experiment. Okay, so one would like to treat this in a quantum theory of gravity or an approach in some formulation of quantum gravity, but of course this is a way too complicated of system, then there is no quantum theory of gravity ready to address this question in this setup. However, and this is what I want to tell you today, it is possible to address this in a toy situation, namely in quantum cosmology, and more precisely in loop quantum cosmology, which is going to be taken here just as an example where these kind of things can be realized. So loop quantum cosmology it's a model that captures some of the features of Loop quantum gravity. And so, as we will see in a moment, it has discreteness is built into the formulation, in spite of the fact that we are basically simplifying the universe to a finite number of degrees of freedom. So we will see that, in a sense, one of the things that quantum cosmology predicts, or loop quantum cosmology predicts, is that you can evolve through the singularity. You can start from a collapsing universe that goes through the singularity and bounce back again. And so what we're going to see is that in the model, evolution from an initial state to a final state after the Big Bang is unitary. But if you look at what's happening from a point of view of coarse grain observers, then you can have a pure state evolving into a mixed state in the future. Okay? If you forget about some Planckian details, if you're, by definition, your coarse grain observers are not sensitive to these Planckian details, then you will have mixed state, a pure states evolving into mixed states, or you would observe an apparent lack of unitarity, simply because you're forgetting about some degrees of freedom. Okay, so in the context in which we're going to apply this, so the model is constructed in the context of unimolar gravity, which I also mentioned in my previous talk. Unimolar gravity is very nice to treat, to deal with this problem, because in the unimolar gravity in cosmology is gives you a framework in which there is no problem of time. So unimolar gravity is just like general relativity, which with an additional condition, you require, you fix a preferred four volume background. And from that condition, you get the trace-free Einstein's equations that we discussed about the other day. So, but if you write the action of unimolar gravity in the case of FRW spacetimes, then this fixing of the volume form becomes this condition that completely fixes the lapse. And this is because you don't have any other degrees of freedom. Then the Hamiltonian constraint disappears, and you have a true Hamiltonian. And if you write things in appropriate variables, this Hamiltonian for the pure gravity case is extremely simple. It's just the Hamiltonian of a point particle, okay? Where the variables that you have to use to get that is time, that this is the natural time in unimolar gravity, the four volume elapsed by a fiducial cell. So you use the four volume of the universe as a clock. The variable x is the volume of the universe divided by L Planck squared just to get it in dimensions of length. And p is a conjugate momentum. So if you write the action of pure gravity, namely you have not put any matter, then this is a point particle. Couldn't be simpler than that. So what is the loop quantization? So the loop quantization is not the Willy-the-Witt quantization. You use a special and very peculiar representation of the canonical commutation relations, or the canonical variables, the p and the x, which is given here. In fact, the inner product between states in the Hilbert space is given not by an integral over x, but by a sum over x's of this quantity here. So in fact, you have a basis, an orthonormal basis, which is just the analog of the spin network basis in loop quantum gravity. And this is given by this delta, Kronecker delta, states. So a state that is zero everywhere, a wave function that is zero everywhere, but is one at x at some real number, is normalizable here. And it has norma one from this inner product. And it represents one element of an orthonormal basis. This is this Hilbert space is huge. It's non-separable, as you can already see. So a basis of this Hilbert space cannot be countable. It's labeled by a real number, the position x0. And this mimics some properties, even though we don't expect the Hilbert space in loop quantum gravity, or the physical Hilbert space, to be non-separable. We do know that the Hilbert space is much larger, so contains degrees of freedoms that are not necessarily there to begin with, because of the choice of your representation of the fundamental variables. So in this loop quantization, the operator P does not exist. So there is no operator associated to the momentum. But the thing that exists are finite shifts So the shift operator, which is to be thought in analogy with the holonomy of the connection in loop quantum gravity. It's exactly the same situation. The connection in loop quantum gravity doesn't exist as an operator, but only holonomies of the connections do exist. And the shift operator is denoted in this way, does this. So it would correspond to, I mean, I write it in this way because it reminds you of what it would be a finite translation in quantum mechanics. But you have to remember that P does not exist, but only this operator exists that shifts by a given value. K is the amount, K is a label in the shift operator that tells you how much you shift a state. So eigenstates of the shift operator are like plane waves, like eigenstates of the momentum. Of course, these are not normalizable states. So like plane waves, they're not normalizable either. But it's very convenient to think of in terms of these plane waves. Then we're going to work with wave packets in a moment. So a plane wave state looks like this. It's labeled by a P0. You have this collection of faces. And plane wave states are supported on lattices with a given regularity. So an eigenstate of such a shift operator will be a state which is different from zero on a lattice with this spacing. And its value is given by these faces. And now it is easy to just check that such a state is an eigenstate of the shift operator with eigenvalue given by this phase. Now the point is that if I shift this lattice by epsilon, and I define a new plane wave on this new lattice, I get another eigenstate of the shift operator. So the shift operator is labeled by P0 that appears here in the eigenvalue of the shift operator. But it is also labeled by a real number that goes between 0 and 4k. And so there is an infinite degeneracy of these shift states. So the plane waves, the analog of the eigenvalues of the eigenstates of P, now are infinitely degenerate. So we have this degeneracy in epsilon in shifting these lattices, which does not correspond to what you would get if you were doing the standard Schrödinger representation of the system. In the Schrödinger representation, you just have eigenstates of the P operator are just not degenerate. So and this plays a role now when we come to the Hamiltonian. So remember the Hamiltonian. Now, in unimolar gravity and with the choice of time variable that I am using, then the Hamiltonian is exactly the same thing as a cosmological constant. So eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian are the cosmological constant values. So from now on, often instead of writing h, I would just write lambda. So this is a Hamiltonian. It's basically a point particle, a free particle Hamiltonian. But now we said the P operator doesn't exist. So in the quantization, you have to regularize this expression. And so you write this Hamiltonian in terms of shifts operators. P doesn't exist, but e to the I something times P does exist. So what people do in the standard formulation of loop quantum cosmology is to replace P squared by this periodic function, sine squared of some regularizing, some point splitting scale here. So this is something order one. It's called the area gap times L Planck times P. And you divide by that. So you see that in the limit where this regulator goes to zero, you recover the P square. So but this is an object that can be sensible in the quantum theory because it can be expressed in terms of combinations of the shifts operators. So, and what are the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian? So what are the eigenstates of the cosmological constant? These are just the plane waves we were talking about before. For special values of this lattice spacing, but where the lattice can be shifted by epsilon. So you have eigenstates of the Hamiltonian are labeled by P0 and epsilon. The eigenvalue is given here. And the eigenvalue does not depend on epsilon. So you have this huge degeneracy.
It would be natural to say these are all different families of Hilbert spaces, superselected, which don't talk to each other.
Yeah, that's what people say in loop quantum cosmology, But super selection means that you shouldn't have any operator in your hero space that maps you from one to the other. And this is not the case. As I just showed you, the shift operators map you from one to the other.
But the shifts are with shift smaller than square root of.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So these are exactly these operators. You might say they don't have any. So what is the content of your sentence, but? Why did you say but? I mean, these are genuine operators in your Hilbert space.
Yeah, you could ask whether they should correspond to something, some physical observer. I mean,
no, they correspond to shifts by a trans-Planckian quantity.
Yeah.
So these are exactly the microscopic degrees of freedoms that I want to find. But the important thing is to say that you cannot fix, you cannot you cannot just select one of these lattices and do everything with it and claim that this is a superselected sector, because it's not.
Of course,
there are operators in your Hilbert space.
You would not admit these operators, which.
Exactly. I mean, your representation gives you a whole bunch of new operators that are there. And so if you want to concentrate on a single lattice, then you have to ignore them. And there is no physical reason to do that. So if you just follow the construction.
Let's start with the observable algebra. You claim you should include these translation operators.
They are there. I mean, you should not eliminate them. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's not. That's.
And that's the point. I mean, if you. And that is going to be the point. That is going to be the microstates in terms of which I can. OK. So that was the free Hamiltonian. Yeah.
You assuming that you're not scheme?
Yes, I am.
So the mu bar would be.
No. This is a mu bar scheme. Sorry, I forget the terminology.
So the depends on J.
I am in. Yeah, well, if you go to the variables I am using here, then the J dependence disappears. You just make a canonical transformation. I mean, this is just a technical point. Believe me that this is the mu bar scheme, even though there is, yeah, delta depends on J, if you want, in the. OK, this is just a technical thing. So, but I am in the usual mu bar scheme. So what happens when you add matter? And I like this very much, because it's such a very simple toy model. I mean, I don't think you can really predict physical stuff with this about our universe, because the universe, because precisely of the existence of these degrees of freedoms that you are just forgetting about when you. But unimodular quantum cosmology is much nicer than the usual one, as you will see. First of all, we have this very we have a Hamiltonian, so there is no problem of time. So I just described the pure gravity Hamiltonian so far. But what happens when you include matter? So let's say you include a massless scalar field. And so the massless scalar field Hamiltonian looks like this. This is the p of the scalar field square. And x appears here in the denominator from the coupling to the geometry. And so it turns out that the Hamiltonian, if you just look at it, becomes something like that. So you get the lambda 0 term, which is the one we described before. I have added the 0 to remind you that this is the pure gravity term of the Hamiltonian. And remember, I am calling it lambda because in these variables is the cosmological constant. And then you get this contribution from the matter with a sign here, which is important. And it's not surprising, because if we were not in unimolar gravity, then you would get a Hamiltonian constraint, which basically tells you that the matter, that the gravity side of the constraint must be equal to the matter side of the constraint. That's why you have this minus sign. But look, imagine that you are in an eigenstate of the momentum of the scalar field. So the momentum of the scalar field is conserved because it commutes with Hamiltonian. So this is basically going to be a constant. And so for some eigenvalue of the momentum of the scalar field, then what we are dealing with is just with a particle. Remember, this is just a p squared term. It's a point particle with an interaction. So the matter contribution is just an effective potential. So the problem of evolving across the singularity is just a one-dimensional scattering problem in quantum mechanics. Not in standard quantum mechanics, in polymer quantum mechanics, because remember, we are in this special representation. And so the 1 over x squared thing here, people quantize it in a way that would avoid problems at x equal to 0. And because of lack of time, I have written the standard quantization of 1 over x squared using the Tiemann trick. But there is a bunch of possibilities, different quantizations. And the simplest one is one that Ed Wilson Ewing just told me about recently, is the one in which you just use for 1 over x squared. The following quantization is just 1 over x squared for x different from 0 and 0 for x equal to 0. That is also that also would work. Okay. So the point is that the matter contribution looks like an effective potential in a scattering problem. And so now we are ready to go. We can set up an initial condition on this side and send the state. But even that, I mean, even a scattering problem in one dimension can be very complicated, but can be difficult to solve explicitly. So let me just simplify my life. And I hope you will believe me that nothing important really happens when if I replace my realistic matter Hamiltonian by this, which is just a Kronecker delta Hamiltonian. Everything I will say from now on is remains valid qualitatively for the realistic situation. Okay? And because I'm not concerned with trying to make some prediction about the CMB or anything like that, I just want to illustrate this scenario. I'm going to work with this because I can solve this explicitly. And Lautaro Amadei, he's actually doing this numerically, and so everything I'm saying is just it just remains the same, up to, of course, quantitative differences in numbers. So we're going to just do a one-dimensional scattering process with this potential. With what initial state? So this is going. This is our wave packet representing the universe, you know, picked at some volume, three volume. I'm going to superimpose this. Oops. With another wave packet, which is exactly the same one shifted by epsilon. Okay, these two states, the red one and the blue one, are just orthogonal in the Hilbert space. So I am superimposing a state that is supported on these bars here with a state that is supported on the crosses. So I am superimposing two states on different lattices. Okay. In this way, so p, so I just have a collection of plane waves that make a wave packet picked at some p. So p1 means the plane waves supported on the bars, and p2 are the plane waves supported on the crosses. Okay. And now just see what happens. Let's say that x equal to 0 is one of the crosses, then only one of the two components will actually scatter non-trivially, while the other one will just go through for my very simple potential. But this is not important. Even if we were in the physical situation, the crosses, the state supported on the crosses and the state supported on the bars will not see the same potential. Okay? And so dynamically, they will evolve differently through the singularity, and that's a key point. So in this case, I can solve exactly the dynamics. So I write the time-independent Schrödinger equation. So this finite difference that you see here is nothing else but the analog of the Laplacian in the continuum representation. You get the finite difference equation because remember that instead of p squared, we have this combination of shifts operators, which are finite translations. So you don't need to see and understand this in great detail. You just have to trust me that this is the regular Schrödinger equation in this representation, and that you solve by very similar means as a one-dimensional Schrödinger equation in a scattering process in the Schrödinger representation. So you make an ansatz, and you have a transmission coefficient and a reflection coefficient that is determined by this equation by continuity at x equal to 0. And this is a solution. And so now we take our initial state, and that defines this density matrix. So if I think now of my initial state is picked on a given p. So this is a density matrix in which I have dropped everything but the fact that I can have this plane wave moving towards the singularity or being reflected by the singularity. So and I have components. So this is PP component P minus P. So this is the PP component in the in the bars. This is the P minus P component in the bars. This is the PP component in the cross terms, bars, crosses, and so on. So I get a four-dimensional density matrix that looks like that. And it evolves unitarily to this thing here, because I can solve the equation exactly. And the evolution is just unitary. But now, it comes to point, if I am a low-energy observer, so remember, the eigen asymptotically, so each eigenstate of the energy, which is the cosmological constant here, is infinitely degenerate. But if I am a low-energy observer, I only know about two quantum numbers. Let's think if I had done the usual Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. So energy eigenstates will be doubly degenerate. I can have a given P, so a given cosmological constant, would correspond to two situations. Either the universe is contracting or the universe is expanding. So these are the only quantum numbers that I want to recognize as macroscopic. All the rest is microscopic degrees of freedom. So I will define, I will declare that coarse grain observers are not sensitive to the others. And so I define now a density matrix, a reduced density matrix, in which I sum over these two possible situations, because I assume that these two are just the same for me, a low energy coarse grain observer. And so the initial state remains pure, but now the evolution takes me to this state, which is no longer pure, and entropy increases by an amount that if you think, if you consider the situation where the initial wave packet had a very small cosmological constant, so to first order in cosmological constant, you get an expression like this. And if you, just to write something explicitly, otherwise you just calculate it, and you get an entropy contribution in the evolution. So here, the in state is the universe that is contracting, and the out state is the universe that has gone through the singularity. So you see that in evolution through the singularity, you get the entropy jumps by a finite amount for these coarse grain observers. So these coarse grain observers will declare that there is something wrong, evolution is not unitary, but in the fundamental theory, everything is fine, evolution is unitary if you keep track of this fundamental microscopic degrees of freedom.
So you have an infinite degeneracy, mm-hmm. but you chose to only introduce a twofold degeneracy.
Exactly.
And if I would a finite number, but if you use the infinite degeneracy, you get an infinite number?
Well, you have to work with normalizable states, okay? So if I use three, I mean, I can write a finite combination of them, and then the entropy capacity of my system would go up. Here, the maximum amount I can create is log two. But if I would combine three, then I would have log three, and so on.
So it's a free number which you can choose.
Yes.
E power beta.
It's a toy model, okay?
I just asked for.
But that's exactly, yeah, the case. Okay, and so all I have said is just standard loop quantum cosmology. So I have not modified the system in any ways. And this is new. I talked about this in loops, but I talked about something else, which I will mention briefly now. The other thing that you can do is the following, which might be a little bit more intuitive, and it has to do with the mu bar scheme. So we said that in order to regularize the Hamiltonian, you need to introduce this regulating scale, this point splitting regulator. And in the standard construction of the model, one thinks that this scale comes from some, is motivated by something in the background, in the full theory. So that there is a background quantum state of the universe that tells you what is the minimum area that you can have in this background. So let me, so in this, now I'm modifying standard loop quantum cosmology by assuming that that background is actually a superposition of two different quantum states with different area gaps. And the model can be easily generalized to that. So you have now a Hamiltonian that acts on a tensor product. So the Hilbert space becomes a tensor product of the loop quantum cosmology, Hilbert space times this finite dimensional Hilbert space, because I declare this combination to be finite dimensional, that I have only one qubit. And so my Hamiltonian acts on this. So the area gap becomes an operator in the microscopic Hilbert space. So I act here, S represents one of these two possibilities in a very simple and natural way. So my Hamiltonian just will act diagonally on this factor because these states are supposed to be eigenstates of this regulating quantity. And then on the loop quantum cosmology state, I act with Hamiltonian that is regularized with the area gap associated to the microscopic state. And if you do that, then you can play the same game because you can then say that macroscopic observers are not sensitive to this underlying microscopic degrees of freedom, and so you will define a reduced density matrix by tracing out this factor of the Hilbert space, and in general, you might produce entropy. So the nice thing about this model is that even when I don't have any interaction, even in the free pure gravity case, then there will be decoherence. And the reason is very simple. If I expand, so these are the energy eigenvalues. These are the things I called lambda before. I'm sorry, I changed the notation because I took this from another talk. But these are the energy eigenvalues, which are proportional to the scalar curvature. It's the cosmological constant. So remember, these are the quantities we had. But now delta has become a quantum operator. Okay. And so if I expand this in powers of L Planck, you see that you get the usual thing, the Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian. But then you get terms which can be interpreted as interaction terms between the Wheeler-DeWitt degrees of freedom and the granularity degrees of freedom. So you can immediately see that the unitary evolution would produce, if I start from a state that has no correlations like this one between the macroscopic degrees of freedoms and the microscopic degrees of freedoms, this Hamiltonian will entangle the degrees of freedom, that will produce the correlations with the microscopic degrees of freedoms. So even if I don't have matter, then entanglement entropy will grow. However, if the scale of curvature, if the cosmological constant value of the universe is sufficiently low, then these terms are subleading. So for states of my universe which are sufficiently low curvature, far away from the Planck scale, the evolution would seem to be, the effective evolution for coarse grain observers would seem to be unitary, would be unitary to a very good approximation. But as curvature grows and I approach the Planck curvature, then the decoherence effects become important. And this is what you see in this picture. So if p, remember p squared is a cosmological constant, for low p's, this is how the entanglement entropy grows as a function of time. So basically here the entropy remains zero. I increase the values of p's and then the entanglement entropy grows faster. So, which is a very expected feature. So if my states have curvatures which are very low and far away from this granularity scale, then I wouldn't expect correlations to be established with it, and I would expect very low decoherence. And in the other case, the decoherence becomes strong. However, as soon as I introduce matter, no matter how small my curvature scale is, when the universe is large, curvatures will become very large, close to the Big Bang, and this decoherence will happen. So decoherence becomes unavoidable in the evolution through the Big Bang. So the entropy jumps generically when crossing, there would be singularity. And how do I know this? I mean, you can either do numerical simulations that Aldar is working on, or you can work with my toy model of the interaction in which I can do the exact calculations. So entropy jumps. And in the whole system, energy is always conserved. The Hamiltonian is independent of time. So the cosmological constant before and after is the same. So this is a perfect example of Unruh's decoherence without dissipation, which is behind all this. And you need this decoherence without dissipation if you want to resolve the Hawking information puzzle for the energetic reasons that I mentioned at the beginning. So if I burn a library, then nobody would claim that information has been lost. We know that information is only degraded. The fire has put the degrees of the macroscopic degrees of freedoms of the words in my library in contact with the microscopic degrees of freedom of the molecules, and the library is still written, the information is still written, these correlations. At least this is what we believe, and this is what we don't claim, that this is a problem with unitarity. Similarly, this is what seems to me the most natural thing to be expected in black hole evaporation. The analog of the fire is the singularity. So black hole collapse puts macroscopic degrees of freedoms that we have learned to describe in effective field theories with these microscopic degrees of freedoms that we might not perhaps be able to describe in effective field theories. And so information is not lost in the evolution. It's just degraded in correlations between field theoretical degrees of freedoms, the Hawking radiation, and these microscopic Planckian defects. The picture is very much like the one I began with. So we form a black hole, we throw a library in. So information in the library is not lost. It's just encoded in these defects after evaporation. So what one is saying is that the Minkowski spacetime before black hole formation and after black hole formation are not the same Minkowski spacetime. They differ by tiny differences in their correlations of these defects with what is what remains at the end. So this is where the library still should be written. And I have basically finished, so I have a few statements that so black hole thermodynamics suggest that black hole entropy, through black hole entropy, that physics should be discrete at the Planck scale because of the necessity of explaining the entropy of a black hole. And I think the need of unitarity in the context of Hawking's information puzzle strengthened this necessity. I think because this is such a natural possibility for a resolution of the puzzle, I think the puzzle itself is telling us nature should be discrete at the Planck scale, as in some of approaches to quantum gravity that we are exploring. And I hope I convince you that this toy model that we study captures all these features. And with that, I would like to thank you very much.
Yeah. Just to be very provocative. So I like the toy model explanation. But would these scenarios not work with any kind of degrees of freedom on the microscopic level, which we not have access for, which do not necessarily need to be discrete? I mean, why is there...
The conclusion is that this toy model illustrates very well the idea that I want to communicate.
Yeah.
And it comes from a quantum gravitational theoretical framework.
There's a very stringent conclusion that...
The conclusion is that discreteness is that if there is discreteness, then very naturally these kind of things would happen.
I see this connection. I don't necessarily see.
What is the other connection? What is it that
you show us a model in which it works?
It's
which does not exclude the possibilities that there are other models in which it works.
Okay, so I think that any model that has this of course, if the world is like that, and if space-time geometry is emergent, and there are these more fundamental degrees of freedoms that we cannot access with effective field theory, then this will generically happen.
Yeah.
And you don't need a model to say so. Okay. So having a model puts things in a more concrete setup.
So then the conclusion is that also as an effective field theory, something like wild gravity, which is non-unitary, would be okay.
Might be okay. Yes. I mean, it will only be okay if you have a more fundamental description in which you understand why it's not unitary.
Also, the question is, you have to be very careful to make sure that, like, for example, LHC scale physics doesn't excite those Planckian degrees of freedom. So, I mean, in your time, you probably we're not able to look into this, but that's something, of course.
Well, in the toy model, what we see, you see a hint of it. When the curvature of the universe is sufficiently low, then you don't excite these degrees of freedom. So the entanglement starts being effective when the curvature is of the order of the Planck scale. So in LHC physics, presumably you're very far from that regime, and that's why we don't observe violations of unitarity.
But you could just put a massless scalar field onto it. You didn't put more matter into your model that's interacting among itself anyway. So you don't expect that to happen, even if you have interacting matter in your toy model.
I don't know. I mean, you're asking if I can do a toy model that is more realistic and has the interactions of the standard model. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah.
But would you like me to come in 2 years and give another talk about that here? No.
Because I won't be here anymore, but if you can, it would be great.
No, I think it would be, it might be possible, but I don't know if I don't know if I will keep thinking about these things. Because, I mean, what do we really gain with this? I think I wanted to have a model in which these ideas, which were more or less just words so far, become concrete and mathematically.
Through loop corrections, if you can, is that the kind of idea that you have? Through interaction and loop corrections, you could excite these things even.
I mean, there are many problems. I mean, this model, first of all, violates Lorentz invariance. So it selects a very preferred frame. And this is very problematic for many other reasons. If you put some quantum field, interacting quantum field on top of it, then the kind of things I mentioned in the other talk would start happening. You would produce large violations of Lorentz invariance that are totally ruled out by experiments. So this is only a toy model. This cannot be taken that seriously, because of all these problems that are open issues in loop quantum gravity in particular. So how is it that we recover something that is actually compatible with low energy Lorentz invariance? So I wouldn't push this model too far.
I was just curious, I didn't mean it as a
critique. No, but I understand.
Steps.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting possibility, but it would be full of dangerous, of dangers of other nature. Of different nature.
Any more dangerous questions? Okay, well, if that's not the case, let's thank you again.
Thank you.